All right, Ryan, right off the bat, I will agree. This is confusing. I even sent a message to contacts I had in Oklahoma City saying, "Hey, when do you publish that check altitude? Because I see it on some RNAV approaches and not on others." They sent me back an answer that I still don't completely understand. It was complicated enough. I found out they evaluate it. They think about it when the precision approach fix, the glide path, is more than a mile from the final approach fix. And then even then, it might not be there. So put all that aside, what is a pilot supposed to do here to stay safe and know when something matters and when something doesn't?
Yeah, it's definitely kind of a confusing issue. I guess in some cases you have the resource of the check altitude, in some cases you don't. When you have it, it's a great last chance to make sure that you didn't make some egregious altimeter setting error or something like that. And when you don't have it, you have to use what you have. So be extra careful about setting the altimeter. Make sure you get the setting right. You know you're going to be in a certain ballpark around the glide path intercept. So it's if you're 500 feet off of where you expect you're going to be based on where the at or above altitude is, then that should maybe raise alarms. But I suppose you just work with what you have available.
Now, you mentioned not using GPS altitude, which is often different, but is there a way, we all have that now. Is that a reasonable thing to at least do a sniff test, if you will, a comparison? Say like, yeah, that's a reasonable altimeter. Like, whoa, that's way off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be way off sometimes just routinely. Like in this example, it's off by 300 or 400 feet, and that's the way it should be because the GPS altitude is not subject to those non-standard temperature errors. And it's in some cases probably giving you a truer indication of your true altitude, but that's not what we use. So, yeah, I mean, it's not in my routine to check the GPS altitude on every approach against the altitude at the final approach fix or any charted altitudes. But I suppose if you think it's way off, that's another thing that you could use.
Or maybe that's just the man with two watches thing, never knows what
Yeah,
time it
right.
is,
Yeah.
right? You're actually creating more confusion than it is. You said you even brought this up in a IMC club meeting and people were confused there.
Yeah. A lot of the answers were, well, we ran the formula here, or we looked at the conversion chart, and we know the altimeter is off by this amount. So why not just go ahead and make the correction and be as accurate as possible? And I guess it comes down to when are you going to draw the line. It's not a trivial process to go through on every procedure to make these corrections. And so where do you draw the line? If you do make the correction here, do you also make it when it's, 0 degrees Celsius? Do you make it anytime it's below standard temperature? And I think the bottom line is that line's already been drawn for us. It's when the plate has a snowflake on it. So in every other case, the errors that are inherent, given a wide range of different weather conditions for that area are small enough to not matter.
Just from a pragmatic sense, I'll be honest, I have never, ever set GPS altitude in the MFD because there's so much other information that is so much more important to me. And to have it there only creates confusion that I don't need.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think I would use it as a to verify your altimeter at all.
And I think if you start correcting each time, you're simply adding another potential error. I mean, this is confusing enough. I mean, they teach high to low, look out below, and it becomes a mantra without ever understanding it, just so you can answer some written test questions. Here's a real application of it. And, I mean, and I could just easily see somebody moving the altimeter in the wrong direction, just as easily as putting it in the right direction.
Absolutely. I'm so numerically challenged. I keep this away at arm's length.
I wonder if ATC might be some help here. If you're off by 300 and some feet, as it looks, would they be getting an alert, or could you ask them, confirm my altitude?
Well, they're not going to get an alert because you're not in close proximity to terrain or anything like that. And they're getting, remember, mode C comes off your encoder, okay, which is transmitting pressure altitude.
Don't they correct for that, though?
It's corrected only for the local altimeter setting. But where you do run into it is if you have to get into the cold weather correction thing, if you had a snowflake, and then you have to go to that chart, and you might have to add 200 or 300 feet. And there's actually phraseology for that. So if they said, for example, in a lower altitude approach, you know, maintain 3,000 on this published segment, you might have to come back and you determine that you really need 3,200 on this segment because of the cold correction. You actually have to tell them, unable 3,000, request 3,200 for cold weather. And the ATC handbook says that they're not allowed to deny requests for cold corrected altitudes. The other thing that they mention is that nowhere will you find any of this stuff in like NOTAMs or anything. It's pretty much up to you to figure it out. It's not going to be published for that airport that, you know, we're in a cold weather situation today or whatever. So to get back to your question, there is an interaction there that needs to be clarified. It may not come in this case. If you cross that fixed 300 feet high or 300 feet low, they're not going to care.
Yeah, well, and actually on this approach, we're on the glide path, so we're physically in the correct place the whole time. The issue is, are we going to take it 300 feet further than we should if our altimeter is
wrong? Or if you had applied one of these erroneous corrections and you were 300 feet off.
Yeah.
That far back on the approach, unless you were in close proximity to terrain, they're not going to notice it nor care.
Right, because you're in at or above altitudes right there, so you're pretty good. You're talking about with notifying them if you had a specific altitude you were told to fly, maybe on an intermediate segment.
Exactly.
And that's something people don't think about with cold weather corrections. It's not just the approach. I mean, it dials back a long way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that snowflake could be from the initial approach fix and have nothing to do with the final approach fix. You know, it's not something you run into very often, but, you know, we're supposed to be able to do it. You know, Bruce, you're like an expert on the GTN in general. I just noticed on ours that the latest software, you can actually have the GTN do the calculation for you. Have you gotten a chance to explore that at all?
I have not tried that yet, but I did notice that when I was going through the updates for the latest software for the GTN series, and it does allow you to go in and apply corrections, and it also helps you, I think, with some of the calculations. So it's certainly something to play around with, perhaps in one of the simulators, before you go up in real life in cold weather and try that.
I think another point about these errors is they're actually not an exact science in practice, because the chart and the formula depends on sort of the same relationship with standard all the way up. I mean, we know that's not the case. So when the chart says an error is 300 feet, it could be 400, it could be 200. Or
you might have to interpolate depending upon where you are in the temperature bands and stuff like that. So, so I'm flying in Florida from now on.
Everyone around the table is shaking their heads like, there's no way I'm going to do this.
I was just saying the one thing missing from this airplane is a radar altimeter, which would be a big help, right?
Yeah. It would make you feel a lot better about the whole
especially
thing.
As you get close to the decision.
Then you'd have four watches.
I'll admit that Ryan living in Wisconsin has to deal with this about 9 months out of the year, okay? And John, who flies to Florida for the winter or the Caribbean or whatever, doesn't have to worry about it. There's another issue, though, that I'd like to talk about with GPS altitude and the fact of the difference between GPS altitude and true altitude. And that is if you're using an iPad, for example, as a emergency instrument to fly an approach, that altitude that reads out on the altitude tape is GPS altitude and not true altitude or pressure altitude. And I found that I bought a mini when I added ADS-B to my airplane. I bought a mini to mount right on my yoke. So if I had to, and the first time I flew it, I was comparing that with two altimeters and it was off by 300 feet.
It's because
and that could have killed me.
Yeah, because you know, MSL, it's a pressure altitude and it's mean sea level. What does that mean? Average worldwide. Whereas GPS, it's based on that WGS-84. It's a theoretical data or mathematical model of because the Earth's not round.
It's pear-shaped.
So it's two different measurements off two different systems. You know, most of the time it works pretty well, but as you explained, it doesn't necessarily always.
And it depends how accurate the GPS is that you're using. You know, the GPS, if you're using your iPad that has the GPS that it came with, the assisted GPS, they call it, that needs the cell network to help its accuracy, that's one thing. You get your GPS altitude from the panel or from a WAAS receiver, that's actually a different thing and maybe just as accurate as the glide path. I mean, you got to remember here, we're talking about position in space, right? So if you can figure out where that position in space is, a WAAS-1 may be accurate enough, or is accurate enough to actually fly approaches on. But again, the approach is based on this path in space, and you're just based on an altitude, which is GPS altitude, which may not be the same path in space. It gets complicated.
Plus or minus the 75 feet in your altimeter, and you know how close is the pressure station that you're getting the setting from, and
all kinds of variables here.
Yeah, right. Which is actually why the GPS is probably more accurate. It's just referenced off a different data point, which doesn't help us if we're not using that same data point.
But what it does bring up, and what's interesting that you've brought up, Ryan, is how much slop there is in what we consider this incredibly precise system. You know, we fly 3,000 feet. It's not 3,001. It's not 2,999. It's 3,000.
But this difference does go away as you approach the runway, lower altitudes. So it's minimized.
Right. But they can be rocks along the way.
Well, it could be.
and it goes back to what you were saying, that you know, it's not only that final segment, it's the intermediate segments and the feeders that can be 20, 30 miles away from the airport. And in this case, there's a lot of brown on that approach plate.
Yeah. Well, presumably, this approach does not have a snowflake, and that would indicate in the temperature extremes that this location has experienced, rocks don't come into play.
Well, they look at it historically.
Yeah, historically.
So the historical
temperature
spread in this airport doesn't qualify for the snowflake.
Right, right. So you're saying global warming could change this whole thing.
Right. Well, it's all going to go away.
You know, one thing when you brought up, Doug, and it's sort of relevant here too, in that the altitude and GPS altitude is for traffic as well. Mm-hmm. And we hear that, you know, we get that a lot with people being like, my iPad says the traffic's here and my MFD in the display says the traffic's 300 feet lower, but one of them is relative to my GPS altitude and one of them is relative to my barometric altitude. So this is one of these things that sort of permeates, you know, all of our flying in all these weird little ways. Something completely, you know, changing gears a little bit on this approach is choosing which one to fly. You know, regardless of what this pilot does, let's presume that they just go with it. They follow the glide path down to minimums. They're approaching a runway that doesn't have approach lights and doesn't have centerline lights, even though they can get down a little bit lower. You weigh that decision. I mean, I've always felt like, boy, I like having approach lights when it's tight.
I would definitely go with the approach that has the approach lights. That would be my preference.
Would you do that even though that one was it was seriously questionable whether you were going to break out and you'd try it again on the other one? Because that's kind of the debate here, right? I've got one that I'm almost certainly going to break out, but I don't have the visibility aids at the end. I got the other. Ooh, that's going to be really tight. But if I do break out, I've got the visibility aids. How do you weigh that?
For me, visibility will always rule. If it's a visibility issue, if it's a ceiling issue, I mean, because it could be a very low ceiling, but, you know, severe clear underneath that, say it could be 200 and a zillion, what's the issue? And so the answer to me, there's not a rock solid answer, but it's what are the limits? What's the risk of one versus the other? If it's a visibility issue, obviously the lighting's going to be more important to me. If visibility isn't the issue, then it's the ceiling. And it could be both.
If the weather is as advertised here, the left side approach is not going to get us in because we'll still be in the clouds at that point. But I still actually think I'd probably want to try that one first, given that we've got plenty of fuel in this scenario to try both of them. I think I like the approach lights and the centerline lights, and I'm willing to take the chance that the ceiling's actually 50 feet higher. So.
I'd go with you on that. That makes a lot of sense here.
I'd have to look. Is there approach lighting on 28 left?
28 left, yeah. 28
left has a center line and approach lights.
Yeah. Yeah,
the right side has lower minimums but no lights.
You'd have the ability to come lower if you had the approach lights.
Pick up those lights, yeah. Yeah, well, we've got, you know, 6,000 feet RVR and blowing snow here. So, you know, that's a that's a terrible visibility situation. You know, you break out and suddenly you're in hyperspace, you know, with everything coming towards you. So,
and it does have a pretty good approach light system on 28 left. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that would really help. Mm-hmm.
There's the separate issue with hot temperatures. Do we even want to go there today?
Yeah, I think I just, you know, that was where I was going next, is this whole thing can bite you in reverse and has gotten a lot of pilots going into LAX, gotten violations coming in when it's extra warm and they do the right thing and grab the glide slope outside of the final approach fix. I mean, I've seen a lot of nods around the table. Does anyone want to jump on that one?
Well, it's not likely to be a visibility issue if it's that hot. You're probably going to be able to see things, but you're absolutely right. That's probably the problem. You're going to violate a restriction on a procedure and cause ATC to bark at you.
Yeah, these approaches at LAX have, you're tracking the localizer from 30 or 40 miles out or something like that, and there's half a dozen step downs as you go down, and so people just pick up the glide slope and follow it, and so with respect to terrain, they're fine. They're on the glide slope, but the altimeter is indicating lower than they actually are the whole time. Since ATC is separating based on what your altimeter says, and they are running traffic underneath this glide path the whole time, you can have separation issues there. So on a really hot day, you got to make sure you hit those step downs. And most approaches are designed with that in mind, but sometimes it's not possible.
And that's also an issue. I know you're in Florida, and you've got the approach into Orlando Executive, which has a mandatory altitude.
Right.
You know, that's where you're really going to see a difference, because if you're too high, you're right at the international's
right. Teterboro has it too. Torvi, it's the 1500 with the line above and below, and you actually have to get below the glide slope, and you don't re-intercept the glide slope till you're at Torvi. If you follow it down, you'll get yelled at.
Yeah, and maybe that's kind of the takeaway from this whole thing is, you know, we get this warm, fuzzy feeling when we're in the embrace of the glide path, you know, finally. Like, I'm established and going down, and that's going to protect me above and below, and I just follow this cone down to the runway. And it's not always that simple. There are, you know, little gotchas that can be hiding in snowflake icons or warm weather, and you're outside the glide slope, and you've still got restrictions that you've got to meet. Specific altitudes that you'd have to be aware of as you're doing this. Or in this case, even if you're doing everything right, you have to know the things that you don't have to worry about and be like, all right, that looks like a problem, but I know what caused it. It's going to resolve itself. I'll just keep track of things as I head down and focus on the final landing.
So the takeaway for you here is the warm, fuzzy feeling.
Yeah, it's the warm, fuzzy feeling itself, yeah.